Welcome to Plan Your Estate Radio with your host, San Jose Estate Planning Attorney Bob Bergman. Bob's been practicing law for over 40 years and is certified by the State Bar of California as a legal specialist in estate planning, trust, and probate law. Bob is here to help you set your house in order with valuable insights you can use today to prepare a better tomorrow for your loved ones. And now, your host for Plan Your Estate Radio, Attorney Bob Bergman.
Good afternoon, Bay Area. This is your host, Estate Planning Attorney Bob Bergman, and I am looking forward to the show today. I'm going to be covering a couple of practice areas that I have as an estate planning attorney. And listen very carefully today, because it's very possible that you're in a situation like I'm going to describe, or you know somebody who is in a situation like this, or you've already been through something like this. And so I'm going to pass on two different types of things that I do as an estate planning attorney that make me somewhat unique in the universe of estate planning attorneys. Not every EP attorney does the kind of work I'm about to describe. It's very specialized work, and it can actually tremendously enhance the situation for a family if things are handled properly, which is something that I really enjoy being able to do for people. And that is actually actually take care of a situation for them that causes them to no longer have an issue with a trust that they're dealing with. So the first thing I'm going to talk about in the first segment today, I'm going to talk about a special type of court petition that I do that is colloquially known as a Hegstat petition, even though the petition itself may not actually involve the same kinds of legal issues raised in the estate of Hegstat, which is the which is basically where the Hegstat petition comes from. But often they're similar enough that we actually end up doing the same kind of thing in court. Now, the Hegstat petition is primarily focused on one thing, although there are other things that can be involved, but it's primarily focused on a trust where someone had a trust and they either had property of some kind, whether it's real estate or bank accounts or brokerage accounts or other assets, titled in their individual name that should have been titled in their trust ownership at the time the person died. A very commonplace situation is that someone owned a house, they put it into their trust, but then later they went to refinance the house, and the lender makes the person or the couple take the property out of the trust in order to put the new loan on. And in the process of that, it's very commonplace that putting the property back into the trust ownership is actually overlooked by the individual or overlooked by the couple. And then years go by, and either the person dies or the surviving spouse dies, and that's when the family first discovers that that real estate is not properly titled in the name of the trust. It's clear that it was intended to be owned by the person or by the couple as a trust asset, but at the time of death, it's not titled that way. In a similar fashion, there could be property acquired later on after someone has set up a trust, either new real estate or they open new bank accounts or brokerage accounts or other things like that. And they may intend them to be in the trust, but they never get around to titling them properly, and they maybe don't even list them as an asset of the trust because they were acquired later on after the person set up the trust. So they never did anything to show that they intended that property to be in the trust. Sometimes, however, there is a schedule of assets that identifies, here are the assets that I intend to be in the ownership of my trust, but they never turn around and actually transfer the ownership into the trust, and then they die. So I have found over the years that with real estate especially, sometimes it's first discovered when the property is listed for sale after someone's died, and then a preliminary title report from a title company shows that this new listed property is not properly titled in the ownership of the trust, but instead is in the individual's name. And sometimes the title company will make that, they'll make that discovery, or the real estate broker will make that discovery. And what can be done then is, if there is sufficient written evidence of intent by the person who owned the property that it be owned by their trust, then it's possible to go to court, filing a Hegstat petition, which I can actually do here in Santa Clara County and San Mateo County, and to a certain extent in Contra Costa County, file it what's called ex parte, meaning with no formal hearing date, as long as every interested person who would be interested in the outcome of such a petition, mainly getting that property into the trust ownership, as long as they all agree with that and waive notice of any hearing and consent to the petition, it can be done without a formal hearing quickly and efficiently to get that asset into the trust. What are some of the things that are considered to be written evidence of intent? First of all, if it's real estate, was it already titled into the trust once, and then was it just taken out to do a refinance? Was it listed on a schedule of assets as being specifically listed as being an asset of the trust, whether it was real estate or bank accounts or brokerage accounts or things like that? Is there a general assignment of assets into the trust ownership that covers the specific type of asset in question? For example, an assignment of all financial accounts, of all stocks, bonds, mutual funds, of all real estate. Or in the case of the assignments that I do, I also include any life insurance or retirement plan where there has been a failure of beneficiaries, meaning that the named beneficiary is not alive at the time the owner of that insurance, the beneficiary owner of the retirement plan, when they die, it turns out they have no living beneficiary. Well, in a situation like that, if I have one written evidence of intent that I could present to the court, I can pretty much do a successful Hegstat petition and get those assets into the trust ownership. In fact, I do have two of those matters coming into my office tomorrow to clear title. And that's exactly the situation that the families are facing. So if this is something that you're facing right now, you've taken over as the trustee of a trust, and you've discovered that mom's house is not in the trust and should have been, or your parents' house is not in the trust, or there's a large bank account or brokerage account that's not in the trust ownership, give me a call, 408-247-0444, or go to my website at lawbob.com and look for the trust petition calendaring links right there, and book a time to talk with me. We can talk and I can see whether or not you're eligible for me to do this kind of work for you and successfully solve a major problem for the family, avoiding a full-blown probate of the asset. Okay, we're coming up at the end of this first segment, and I'm finishing my discussion of the Hegstat petition. When we come back, I'll talk about another specialty court petition. This is Attorney Bob Bergman, host of Plan Your State Radio, and stay tuned for more Plan Your State Radio.
This is Plan Your Estate Radio with San Jose Estate Planning Attorney Bob Bergman on AM 1220 KDOW.
And welcome back to the second segment of our show today. And in this segment, I'm going to introduce a very common situation that I run into with people coming to me. Now, in order to introduce this, I need to give a little bit of history of the of revocable living trusts and generally how they've been prepared historically in California. What I'm going to be talking about primarily in this segment is trusts created for married couples, even though ultimately many of the issues I'm going to talk about today apply both to trusts for married couples and trusts for individuals. But the first section is going to be for trusts for married couples. Now, historically here in California, and I can speak from personal knowledge as I've been practicing in the state since 1980, doing estate planning since 1981, so that's quite some time. Historically, the type of trust that was prepared in California for a married couple was called an AB marital trust or an ABC marital trust. And I'll explain what those mean in a moment. Now, this trust often named the spouses as the trustors or the people who created the trust, and the trustees put in charge of the trust property, and as the beneficiaries or the people who received the benefit of the trust. Now, these early trusts provided that upon the death of the first spouse, who I'll call the deceased spouse, the trust will either will be mandatorily divided into two or more trusts, or, depending on its design, may be divided into two or more trusts to be administered separately from that day on. One or more of the trusts will be for the benefit of the children of the marriage or other heirs of the deceased spouse, while one or more of the trusts will benefit the remaining spouse or the surviving spouse. Now, whether or not the AB or ABC marital trust requires a division of the couple's property into two or more trusts or permits it depends on how the trust is drafted. Most trusts drafted in the 1980s and 1990s, and even some I've seen much more recently than that, in the 2000s and even the 2010s, required the division of the property into two or more trusts after the death of the deceased spouse. Now, way back then, this was normal because the federal estate tax exclusion amount for estates was less than $1 million back then, and this type of estate planning was considered appropriate. Now, the A trust, or the survivor's trust, is the trust established for the surviving spouse. It typically contains one half of the community property owned in the marriage, owned by the surviving spouse, plus any separate property owned by the surviving spouse. This is property brought into the marriage or acquired after the marriage by inheritance, for example, that is maintained as separate from the marriage. It may also contain property left directly from the deceased spouse to the surviving spouse. The survivor's trust is a revocable trust, which means the surviving spouse may amend it, cancel it, or modify it in any way desired. Now, the B trust in an AB or ABC marital trust is more commonly called nowadays the bypass trust. It used to have many other names: the exemption equivalent trust, the unified credit trust, the family trust, which I think was not a good name, but Bypass trust is typically what it goes by now. And that will contain the deceased spouse's half of the community property, typically, plus any separate property owned by the deceased spouse. However, the total value of property that can be placed into the bypass trust without any kind of federal estate taxation is limited to something called the applicable exclusion amount, or AEA, of the deceased spouse, as determined in the year of the deceased spouse's death. Now, the AEA here in 2024 is $13.61 million per individual. It's going to be indexed for inflation next year until January 1, 2026, when the current law expires and the exclusion will roll back to about half of what the exemption was from 2025. Now, the best estimate is that that will be between $6.5 million and $7 million January 1, 2026. Now, the property in the bypass trust and any future appreciation will bypass estate taxation in the estate of the surviving spouse when the surviving spouse dies. But this also has a negative income tax consequence with that, and that is that the cost basis or value of property in the bypass trust for income tax purposes will be fixed at the date of the deceased spouse's death, which means any future appreciation in the growth of those assets, such as real estate, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, things like that, would be subject to capital gains tax when the property is sold later in that trust or later after it's inherited by the person's heirs. Now, with the higher AEA in effect today, the federal estate tax planning purpose for a bypass trust has been largely eliminated for the vast majority of families. Most families do not have an estate of the size that would be concerned about a federal estate tax. But at the same time, forcing a division of the property could lead to the loss of what's called a new step-up in cost basis for the assets that would otherwise go into the bypass trust, and the family ends up dividing up the assets for no income or estate tax benefit at all. In fact, it's detrimental to the income tax for the family. Now, the C trust in an ABC marital trust is called the marital Q-tip, or qualified terminable interest property trust. And basically, any property that is more than the deceased spouse's AEA would typically go into the C trust. Now, for the vast majority of families, this is not going to make sense at all. They're not going to be using that C trust at all. And so that is kind of the situation right there. Now, when we come back after the break, I'm going to talk about the type of court petition that can be filed in order to fix a problem like this, which, by the way, I see regularly in my practice here in San Jose. So stay tuned for the second half of Plan Your Estate Radio today with your host. I'm estate planning attorney Bob Bergman, and we'll pick up this discussion on the other side of the break.
This is Plan Your Estate Radio with San Jose estate planning attorney Bob Bergman on AM 1220 KDOW.
And welcome back. Before the break, I was talking about the very typical type of estate planning that was done here in California for married couples called the AB or ABC Marital Trust. And I've had a lot of surviving spouses come to me who had trusts done back then in the 80s, 90s, and even the 2000s and the 2010s where this was the type of trust that was prepared for them. It was kind of the default trust that was prepared if you use some kind of an online service. Most attorneys prepared them. I had prepared them back then because we never imagined for a moment that we would have estate tax exclusion amounts ballooning from less than $1 million to over $13 million today. That was not really something that was anticipated when these kinds of plans were drafted. Well, here's the deal. It's possible to file a petition with the court in order to remove the requirement that the B trust or bypass trust be created. Now, why would we want to do that? Maybe because we want everything to go to the surviving spouse so that when the surviving spouse passes away, all of the assets of the marriage will be eligible under the Internal Revenue Code, the tax laws for income taxes. All of the assets will be eligible to be revalued to the date of death value for income tax purposes. Now, what that can mean for a family is they're able to now sell that house or that stock or those mutual funds or bonds or whatever it happens to be and cash out and pay no income tax. Whereas if the assets were in a B trust, there might be substantial income tax because the value for income tax purposes was fixed at the time that the first spouse died. Okay, so filing a petition under either probate code section 15403 or section 15409 can be done to remove this requirement, leaving the trust in the position where it is now a fully revocable trust with everything going, typically everything going to the trust, a survivor's trust. This also gives the surviving spouse the ability to redo and update that trust in order to deal with some other reasons why they might want to significantly enhance the existing ability of the trust to handle a number of different things. Now, a typical bypass trust or Q-tip trust, that C trust, created after the death of a spouse, often required that the trust be automatically distributed to the ultimate beneficiaries after the death of the surviving spouse. There's typically no power granted to the surviving spouse to decide that the property is going to go in some different direction, in different amounts or percentages or whatever. Typically, the beneficiaries are fixed. They're solid. There's no ability to appoint the assets anywhere. And a similar issue arises when a trust is established for any beneficiary, where the beneficiary is not given any control over the ultimate distribution of the trust property at the beneficiary's death. So one of the things that can be done even while a person's alive is an irrevocable trust can be modified now to grant the beneficiary of the trust a limited or a general power of appointment. Now, a general power of appointment, if it's properly drafted and now is added into the trust by court action, will cause the assets in that trust to be includable in the taxable estate of that beneficiary when the beneficiary dies. You might say, well, why would you want to do that, Bob? Well, it's very straightforward. If a beneficiary does not have a large personal estate, and then they have a fairly substantial estate left in trust for them, then having the value of that estate left in trust included in their taxable estate at death will mean it will be eligible to have that asset or the assets in that trust for the beneficiary revalued to the date of death value so that they can be passed on to the next generation at the higher value for income tax purposes, which means they could then be sold and not incur capital gains income tax. Kind of a neat trick. A general power of appointment doesn't have to actually be exercised by the person granted the power in order to get the tax benefit of having the power. The Internal Revenue Code and regulations consider that if you have a general power to appoint the assets of a trust, you are treated as if you were the owner of those assets when you die. And ownership of the assets means that the assets are eligible to have the income tax value increased or decreased if it went down in value, but typically increased to the date of death value when that beneficiary dies. That can be a significant cost savings for the beneficiaries after that beneficiary, because now they'll receive the property at the higher value. Properly structured, you can have the assets get a step up in cost basis when the parent dies, and then another step up in basis when the child who received the assets in trust when that child dies. So it's possible to do some additional tax planning by modifying the existing trust that may not have a power to a point like this, but now we've gone to court and we have fixed that problem and we put something in there that wasn't in there before, but we did it because it's going to derive an income tax benefit ultimately for the family. Now, another thing that we're trying to deal with in a situation like this is what I consider to be maybe a much more serious problem than not having the ability to get a new basis in property when someone has died, when the beneficiary has died. And that is no asset protection for the heirs. Excuse me, I need to cough. Now, the typical older trust would provide for outright distribution of trust property to what are called the remainder beneficiaries of the trust. The remainder beneficiaries are those people who are going to inherit the assets after the individual has died or the survivor of a couple has died. So what I'm talking about right here, as well as my prior discussion of using a power of appointment, applies whether there's a marriage or not. It applies to the assets being passed on to the next generation, typically children, but it doesn't have to be children. It could be grandchildren, it could be friends, it could be other family members. The concept is the same regardless of who it is that you're including as beneficiaries. Now, when we're talking about asset protection, if the typical trust said, hey, when I die, I leave everything outright to my son, John. Okay? Now, the problem there is, well, let's start talk first of all about what's the advantage of doing that? Well, it's simple to understand, and it's simple to actually carry out after someone's died. But it completely ignores the very real potential problems of the heirs losing their inheritances as a result of any number of things. Common ways that people lose their inheritance include the following. They're too young. Nobody I know thinks that it's a great idea to leave a significant sum of money or assets to someone who just turned 18 years of age. Certainly, there are 18-year-olds that may be mature enough to actually actually handle an inheritance like that. But the reality is that most will not be, and there's really a major chance that they could lose some or all of their inheritance because they really don't know how to handle money or because someone takes advantage of them. It can also apply when someone is financially immature, just financially immature, which is, by the way, no respecter of age. Someone could be 90 years old and financially immature. So when we come back after this third break, I'm going to talk about other reasons, other potential problems of heirs losing their inheritance, the other kinds of things that can happen. And then I'm going to talk about the solution to this problem, which is something that can be done through this trust modification petition, or it can be done while you're alive right now, making changes to the plan you already have. This is Attorney Bob Bergman. Stay tuned for the final segment of our show today.
Now, back to Plan Your Estate Radio with Attorney Bob Bergman.
Hi, welcome back to the final segment of the show. Before the break, I was talking about reasons why people lose their inheritance. I was talking about how someone could be too young to receive it or financially immature. Another way is people having a drug, alcohol, gambling, or other addiction or abuse problem, which means the inheritance is used to further that addiction or abuse problem. And that can be a real big concern, too. I have people coming in all the time who want to make sure that certain of their children or others cannot actually get direct access to their inheritance because they're afraid if they do, they may use it to literally end their lives through an overdose or something similar. Another thing would be if you have a beneficiary that's in a bad marriage, where it's financially, emotionally, or physically abusive, and receiving the inheritance means that it's basically going to be taken over by that person's partner or spouse and then spent. If someone has pending lawsuits or money judgments against them, or they're in bankruptcy, receiving an inheritance directly could end up having the inheritance taken by the creditor, taken by the trustee in bankruptcy in order to pay off somebody's debts, or meaning that they can't really effectively do anything with the inheritance because they have a lawsuit hanging over their head. Another thing, a special needs person who is relying on government assistance for maybe for housing, for income like SSI, for custodial medical care like long-term care, or their medical insurance, which could be Medi-Cal here in California, well, receiving a substantial inheritance could mean that they lose those benefits at least for a time until action can be taken to establish a special needs trust with the person's inheritance. And then the special needs trust has a requirement that when that person dies, all the monies paid out on behalf of that person by the government get paid back to the government instead of the money going on to other heirs or maybe that person's own children or grandchildren. And it's also very common that someone inherits and they don't do any planning of their own. So we may have avoided probate with the original trust, but then someone inherits and they don't do any estate planning for what they inherited. And then they die and now everything goes through probate, which means it kind of defeated the purpose of the original trust planning. Now we're going to have a probate. And then also the someone is maybe going through the dissolution of their marriage. Well, that can cause problems too, because they may have taken the inheritance and inadvertently mixed it into the marriage so that when the divorce comes later on, maybe half of their inheritance goes out the door with the divorcing spouse because they have made the inheritance, which was separate property, they have made it into property owned by the marriage called community property. Those are just some of the things that that can actually be triggered when you leave an inheritance directly to somebody. Now, what I do to solve that is I do what I call the castle trust planning. Castle trust planning says we're going to leave the property not directly to the person, but we're going to leave it in trust for them. If they're competent and you trust them, they can be in charge of their own inheritance. But the use of the inheritance is limited to using it for health, education, maintenance, and support needs, following what are called ascertainable standards, instead of just, gee, I want it, I want to buy it. And they can be structured so that someone could be put in charge or even appointed by the beneficiary that would have the independent authority to make distributions for any purpose whatsoever. I call it castle trust planning. I discuss it in my webinars, which you can access at my website at lawbob.com. And it's the most effective way I know of to protect an inheritance for a child or a grandchild or other person that you want to make sure their inheritance is protected from creditors, protected from spouses, protected from if they were sued because they're in a high-risk profession or occupation such as law or medicine or accountancy where a malpractice claim could lead to loss of property, including inherited property, unless it's protected behind the walls of the castle trust planning. Well, that's basically a summary today of the two special types of court petitions that I do. If you're facing a situation like that in your life right now with a family trust that you're administering, feel free to contact me, call 408-247-0444, or visit my website at lawbob.com, where you can book a free consultation to talk about that with me. I hope this has been informative for you and that you will pass this information on to others. It will be available as a podcast going forward at kdow.biz. That's all for today. Until next Monday, this is Attorney Bob Bergman, host of Plan Your Estate Radio. Have a great week, Bay Area.
You've been listening to Plan Your Estate Radio with estate planning attorney Bob Bergman. For more information on today's program or to schedule a consultation, visit lawbob.com, L-A-W-B-O-B, lawbob.com, or call his office in San Jose, 408-247-0444. That's 408-247-0444. And be sure to tune in next week for more Plan Your Estate Radio with attorney Bob Bergman.
Opinions expressed in the preceding program do not necessarily represent the views of the ownership, staff, or management of this station and are for informational purposes only and should not be construed to be legal, financial, or tax advice. Seek appropriate legal advice regarding your particular situation. Attorney Bob Bergman does not offer any guarantees with regard to the outcome of your legal matter. Prior results in other cases do not guarantee a similar outcome in your case. All rights reserved.